Morning. This morning, I want to just point out something real quick, because we can learn a lot about American culture just by looking at the cartoons of different generations, okay? So take, for instance, Itchy and Scratchy, all right? Now, some of you may have no idea who Itchy and Scratchy are. Last night, we had woohoos and yay, you know. There we go. That feels better. Some of you are saying, wait, isn't the cat holding a gun? And yes, Itchy and Scratchy are almost a cartoon within a cartoon. They're featured in the Simpsons episodes. And how it basically works is Bart and Lisa are sitting on a couch, and they're watching an Itchy and Scratchy cartoon. And so Scratchy's the cat, Itchy's the mouse there with the knife, the big dagger. Itchy essentially it's very bloody, gory, and Itchy tries to mutilate Scratchy in each of the different episodes. And you almost wince while watching. Some people laugh hysterically. Some people wince. And then what happens then is you flash from the cartoon to the kids on the couch, Bart and Lisa, and they're just laughing hysterically, and they can't stop laughing and all that. Now, you have to take it in context, of course. This is a satirization of other cat and mouse pairs from other generations. And they're really, I mean, where there really is a lot of violence, but you don't see it, you know, and they're just taking that violence to the logical conclusions and sort of just making fun of it. And so it really shows our current culture's bias towards sort of making fun of simpler times and making fun of those that other era. And let's just carry that to the logical conclusions to show you how really messy life really is, and it's not quite that simple. Now, they'll do a bunch of other parodies besides just kind of your traditional cat and mouse thing. I think they've done, a spinoff of some Disney stuff. So instead of like Steamboat Willie, they've done Steamboat Itchy. And instead of Fantasia, they've done Scratchtasia. I believe that's how you pronounce it. But the fact is they're making fun of the classic cartoon era of different generations. Now, they're actually patterned after. I mean, they're actually legitimately patterned right after another cat and mouse team named Herman and Catnip. Now, Herman and Catnip were around from 1944 to 1960. This was an exceptionally predictable cat and mouse team. In these situations, Herman always came up on top. Always. Without fail, it always happened that way. You knew exactly how it was going to end before the whole thing even started. Okay, and so that predictable nature is sort of what the Itchy and Scratchy thing is playing off of a bit. Now, Herman and Catnip are really just a clone of the more famous cat and mouse team most people think of, which is Tom and Jerry, which has spanned six different decades. Now, if you want to learn about American culture, watch Tom and Jerry episodes from different generations. It's amazing to watch this stuff. In the early class, when people say, yeah, I love Tom and Jerry, they almost always mean pre-1960 Tom and Jerry, almost without fail, because it's a very different feel. They changed animation studios. In the early 60s, they outsourced Tom and Jerry behind the Iron Curtain. And people, the shock, the horror. We had communists doing Tom and Jerry? That's not right. And in fact, they had, if you look at the Tom and Jerry episodes at the end, they'll say, like, made in Hollywood, USA. But during the early 1960s, it says nothing. Nothing shows up because they didn't want to say made behind the Iron Curtain, Cuban Missile Crisis. People are just touchy about that kind of thing. But that didn't last more than a few years. And then kind of went to a different phase, and then they messed around with what Tom and Jerry even looked like. So really the classic period and the kind that people tend to make fun of is the pre-1960 Tom and Jerry's. And to some degree, Itchy and Scratchy are sort of making fun of that era as well, although Tom would win once in a while, which made it a little bit different. But here's the fascinating thing about Tom and Jerry, especially pre-1960. While Itchy and Scratchy can make fun and just take the violence to a logical just absurdity, you know, there's one thing Itchy and Scratchy cannot get past the censors today. In fact, if you go to buy a Tom and Jerry DVD, there is a warning on there. It says, not suitable for children. So Itchy and Scratchy with blood and gore can be shown on primetime TV. You go out and buy this, not suitable for children. And it tells you a lot about our culture. There's something in the old Tom and Jerry cartoons that is more offensive than the violence. Racial stereotypes. In fact, it is very hard to see an original Tom and Jerry on TV right now. They've gone through great lengths to edit them. They've censored Tom and Jerry because of the racial stereotypes. They've replaced an African-American woman with a white woman. They've changed the voices. They've changed the background music. So it's very hard to get an original episode of Tom and Jerry pre-1960. Itchy and Scratchy do not go there. They don't try to take that to its logical extreme. So we can see how our culture, we have these different biases, and the cartoons really capture sort of the culture of the day. Now you can see this with some other cartoons. For instance, go back to, another example is 1937 of Snow White and the whole Disney cartoon, okay? Now it's based on the fairy tale and all that, but really, this is right at the dawn of the Tom and Jerry period. And there really was a sense that things, according to this show, all the characters live happily ever after. Evil is vanquished, and the prince comes and kisses Snow White, and how wonderful. And we were nervous for a little while, but we had this hope it would all work out in the end. And sure enough, it did. Isn't that neat? Now flash 70 years in the future, 2007, it's a little bit different. You now have Shrek. Snow White makes an appearance. Snow White is the one in the red right there doing the kung fu move, okay? Very different approach to Snow White. Very different to cartoons. Prince Charming, now the villain. And things don't always work out in the end. You don't want to be a beautiful princess. You actually would rather be an ogre when it's all said and done. And it shows how we have a much more, the current generation takes a much more complex view to life. It's not simple. There's no such thing as a fairy tale ending. You don't live happily ever after. In fact, if you've seen the movie Enchanted, it makes fun of that. That whole idea of wanting to live happily ever after and the absurdity of that in the current generation's mindset. So that's sort of this idea. The current generation doesn't like predictable, doesn't like formulaic, gets really upset when there's this promise of a fairy tale ending. And the interesting thing is that when we approach our faith, we take these biases, these different approaches. And you might think, oh, it must be age. If you grew up watching Tom and Jerry, you fall into that group. If you grew up watching Itchy and Scratchy, you fall into that group. Has something to do with it, but not as much as you'd think. It has a lot to do with your parents, and I think it has a lot to do with how long you've been in the church. But it actually affects sort of how you approach Christianity. And it's really interesting to see how these two groups are sort of working together and interacting in the same congregation. It's fun to watch. But it's even in just in youth ministry, many of the teenagers are kind of the Itchy and Scratchy mindset. And many of the parents are Tom and Jerry. Makes for some good, family interactions. But notice I didn't say all. I didn't say all. It has nothing to do, age factors in, but it, in many ways it happens independent of age. So the fact is that we approach Christianity with these different biases and these different approaches and these assumptions about how life actually works out and how you actually, whether there's kind of like a fairy tale ending at the end or if it just don't even bother. So what I want to look at, though, is to see how this plays out more specifically as we read the Bible. We're going to look at chapter 1 of 2 Peter. Because he's actually talking here about the essence of the spiritual life, essence of Christianity. I want to show you how our own biases affect how we interpret this passage. Okay? See if you can find yourself in this. Here we go. It says, His divine power has given us everything needed for life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who called us by His own glory and goodness. Through these, He has given us His very great and precious promises so that through them you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption in the world caused by evil desires. Okay, let me just go through really quickly what the two groups in this congregation just heard. Because you guys heard this differently. There's one group, and this is kind of how I was raised. I've been in the church all my life. My default is a Tom and Jerry mindset. The very first verse, first part of the verse, it says, His divine power has given us everything needed for life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who called us by His own glory and goodness. That makes sense to me. The more I learn about who God is, about who Jesus is, it gives me the strength I need to live out the Christianity. It helps me know how to be a Christian. That makes sense to me. Now, for those of you who are part of the, who kind of approach this instantly more from an itchy and scratchy mindset, well, let me just say it this way. You probably winced when I said the phrase, very great and precious promises. If I went up to somebody whose natural mindset is more of an itchy and scratchy approach to life, life is complex, kind of a Shrek mentality, and I said, let me tell you about the very great and precious promises of God, I'd probably get beat up, okay? There's this idea, precious promises of God, I don't buy it. Doesn't work out that way. And so the fact is we have two groups struggling here. It's interesting, both are wrong. Remember how I was saying how my initial read of this text is to say his divine power has given us everything needed for life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness? Yeah, the more you learn about God, the more it helps you. Guess what? That's not the Greek. When we translate knowledge, that's a different type of word. This is the knowledge that comes from relationship, not from learning about. As we develop a relationship with God, it is that relationship which gives us everything for life and godliness. It's contrary to our instant default of, ooh, if I learn more, I can live more holy. And it also challenges the group that says, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with this precious promises of God ideal. Because it promises something very huge. That you really can live differently. And it's guaranteed. It really is the fairy tale ending that we're so skeptical of holding on to. So both of us, I mean, both groups here are challenged a little bit when we come to something like this. And so it's fascinating, even though we got two generations of America sort of working through this, if you go back 2,000 years to this original idea, you realize that we all are carrying a little bit of baggage as we go into this whole thing. So what I want to do is look a little bit more closely how this plays out in the next verses and how it even plays out in our Christian walk a bit. So let's start first with the whole Tom and Jerry crowd and their approach. Now, during the Tom and Jerry era, and this would be starting in 1949. Does anybody know who that is, real quick? Billy Graham. Billy Graham on the left, that's from 1949, on the right, your left, Billy Graham, 1949, and then the one on the right is Billy Graham, a modern picture of him. Billy Graham kind of became a national figure during the Tom and Jerry era, starting the idea of the Billy Graham Crusades. How many of you have been to a Billy Graham Crusade? Have you seen a Billy Graham Crusade on TV? How many we got here? Okay. How many of you have been a counselor at a Billy Graham Crusade? Anyone? Okay. This is how the Crusades would work, though. Essentially, he would go into a city, and you know, later in the whole thing, you'd, like stadium, and thousands of people come, and it's over multiple days, and you bring in celebrities that share their testimony, and Billy Graham comes up, and you know, in about a half hour or so, presents the gospel. And you see, and over his ministry career, he has led hundreds of thousands of people to become Christ followers. Staggering. And the amazing thing, for starting in 1949 to the present, really, we've seen the whole televangelist thing come and go. And while people got really skeptical of other people they saw on TV, his credibility remained intensely high because of his desire to just say, I'm just going to live the way Jesus wants me to live, and very straightforward. Even though he was from a political standpoint, counseled many Republican presidents, even though he himself is more affiliated on the Democrat side. And so he has not been able to be pinned down into a label. He's essentially said, I'm going to be a Christ follower, and I'm going to share this information. I'm going to share this message with you. And that had a huge impact on the church and how we approach Christianity. Now, it's important to realize the context that this happened. During the Tom and Jerry era, during the years that followed, you had a relatively, quote-unquote, Christian America. Whether they really believed it down deep, they knew about God. They had some relationship with God. This is the idea of, you know, prayer in school, not a contentious subject. People went to Sunday school maybe almost all their lives. Huge concentration of the population were already Christ followers, kind of. And what they needed was someone to come along and very clearly take them from where they were at, kind of clear up some weird stuff that maybe our culture, you know, Bugs Bunny kind of messed up the theology a bit, but then kind of straighten them out, and they were on their way. Amazingly effective for that period of time. This approach doesn't work as well anymore. They're still going strong, doing a bunch of stuff, and now, you know, kind of the different descendants are doing, you know, you get Franklin Graham, Billy Graham Jr., Billy Graham the Fifth, or whatever. But it's a different, they have to change it slightly because they're dealing with a very different audience. You don't have people that have grown up in the church. You don't have people that have that basic background. It's a very different time. The itchy and scratchy crowd, they don't respond that way. They don't have that same underpinning. And in fact, the itching, scratchy crowd would have a little bit of difficulty with the fact, how on earth can you give me the crux of all of Christianity in a primetime special? It's too snow white, too formulaic, too simple. I don't buy it. And so there's actually a movement within the church. Some of you may have even just seen some of the representative works, but that sees Christianity as much more complex. It takes a different approach. It reflects this different mentality. One representative work of the movement is a book like Blue Like Jazz. Maybe some of you have read the book. It's a very different perspective on Christian spirituality. I'll read a quote from the back cover. I never like jazz music because jazz music doesn't resolve. But sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. I used to not like God because God didn't resolve. But that was before any of this happened. It's not a desire to abandon the faith. It's a reaction. Just as itchy and scratchy are a reaction against that Tom and Jerry or Herman and Catnip world, that predictable, this all works out this way. It's that same current that runs through our culture is running through Christian minds as well and Christ followers, saying, you know what, maybe it isn't that simple. Maybe things are very different. And it's one of the greatest things to happen right now because it's happening with a culture that doesn't have the same context that was around 50 years ago. But the fact is we see the Bible differently. Both groups are represented here this morning, without a doubt. We've got the Billy Graham group. We got the Blue Like Jazz group. And as I flash verses up on the screen, we see them a little differently. And the important thing, though, is to realize that regardless what group we just kind of naturally gravitate to, is that we see our own blind spots and realize that we might miss something because of our framework. Now, there's it's too bad we don't actually have a way of having those blind spots go off and warn us. Some of you, I don't know if anybody here owns a Mercedes with this feature, but the newer Mercedes-Benz features offer a cool little thing. It's actually a blind spot warning indicator. I was actually, you know, I'm tempted to see if anybody have it, and looks just like that. I'm actually going to read a little quote, a little section from the Mercedes-Benz website talking about this new feature, okay? From Mercedes-Benz.com. You all know the feeling. It's 5:30 a.m., time to get to work. The early bird gets the worm, at least that's what you've been taught. You're not completely awake, but that's nothing a grande caramel macchiato with whole milk and a triple shot of espresso can't cure. Heading down I-75, feeling the caffeine seeping into your bloodstream, switching lanes to exit when suddenly, bam, you just knocked a hippie kid in his Prius, both of whom had been hiding in your blind spot, into one of the trees he's been diligently attempting to save. Thanks to a new blind spot assist system from Mercedes, this scenario will soon cease to exist. Available on either the S-Class or CL class, the new system utilizes 6 short-range radar sensors, which monitor both the sides and rear of the vehicle, alerting you by use of a red warning symbol in the exterior mirror glass should something be situated in your blind spots. If, in your still unawakened state, you fail to notice this warning and continue attempting to change lanes, when the turning indicator light is activated, the red symbol in the mirror will start to flash and an audible warning will sound, thus alerting you and saving the hippie and his Prius from an unfortunate and untimely demise. Wouldn't it be cool if as we were like opening the Bible and just approaching our faith, if you're on a journey, you haven't even made it, maybe made the jump to be a Christ follower yet, when you had some, when you were looking at your faith with a blind spot, that indicator would kick on and say, hey, you're bringing a bias to the text and you don't even know it, and you're about to crash. Wouldn't that be neat? Because the fact is, when we look back at what was really intended back then, we realize you can't force it into one group or the other. And it's important that we sort of realize, hey, we're bringing a little bit of bias to this whole thing. So let's look back to see what Peter was really intending back there in 2 Peter chapter 1. Let's look at that first verse again. Peter writes, his divine power has given us everything needed for life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness. Now, I mentioned that the knowledge here that he's talking about is not book knowledge. It's not academic knowledge. It does start in a relationship. As we get into this relationship with Jesus, that's where we have the power and the ability to kind of live the life that he's called us to live. But it's really cool to see really how this comes together. How do we start this relationship in the first place? We were called not by a voice, but by his own glory and goodness. What it is as we kind of saw who Jesus was, the glory that we saw there, the goodness that we saw inside of him, there's this desire to say, I want to be like that. There's something so pure about it, we're drawn to it. And as we're kind of just following this, reaching out to God, and that relationship starts, it's out of all that we get everything we need for life and godliness. That relationship kicks off, and that's what fuels us, enables us to live the life that he's called us to live. Now, Peter goes on to say, through these he has given us his very great and precious promises, so that through them you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption of the world caused by evil desires. Now, Peter's not saying we're divine, we're going to become divine. Not saying that at all. But what he's saying is we can participate in the divine nature. Slightly different there. This idea is we're drawn by the glory and goodness of who Jesus is. We want to be like that. We're drawn to the purity. So we start that relationship. But where is it leading? For us to be just like him. Participate in the divine nature. We enter into this relationship to become like that very thing we're attracted to. The goodness, the purity. And that's where both groups can get hung up real quick there. Because the group that my default group, is we can make this a knowledge experience and forgetting it's a relationship experience. And the other group, from a cynical or skeptical perspective, can find it a little bit hard to believe that this actually works. That I really can be different. That I really can know God in the first place. Challenges both groups and challenges our understanding. I want to pause for a second and actually go a little bit to the background of this book, and specifically the Greek culture at that time and what Peter was trying to do. Because as we dig in this a little bit further, it gets even more amazing to see how it all fits together for us. See, he wrote this. Peter wrote this to a very, very Greek set of Christians. They were like, they didn't grow up in the church, so to speak. They grew up reading Stoic philosophy, reading the Greek philosophers. They had a very different understanding of faith. So they were very new to the faith. So what Peter does in this chapter is he is using a ton of Greek culture to explain Christianity, to help them get how this all fits together. So the structure that he uses that we can't even see because it's in English and it's, you know, we got the verses and the numbers and the headings and we miss the structure. The structure would be instantly recognized by someone in that culture as, hey, that's just like our philosophical stuff. Neat. But the words he uses are so unique to Greek philosophy that a lot of the words we're going to see in the next few verses, this is their only cameo appearance in the entire Bible. They're used once. That's it. Ton in Greek philosophy, ton in other Christian literature, but in the Bible, they barely ever show up because they're not the usual translation. This whole thing has led some people to believe that Peter didn't even write the thing, which that's their only evidence. So it's kind of like, well, if he's writing to a completely different group, it would make sense that he has to change how he communicates. So it doesn't hold a whole lot of weight for me. But the idea is that he's trying to communicate Christianity to a group that wasn't raised in it. And it's fast. So he's kind of like got a green field here. How does the whole thing look like from the very beginning? And that can trip up those folks, you know, like myself, that have grown up in the church that kind of experienced Christianity in a world where there was a baseline level of faith. And it also can point some interesting instruction to those that are coming at it fresh, but have a bias to sort of react against the previous generation. So let's look to see what we have in the next few verses and see what we can learn from this. Peter writes, "For this very reason, make every effort by your faith to produce virtue. By virtue, knowledge. By knowledge, self-control. By self-control, steadfastness. By steadfastness, godliness. By godliness, mutual affection. By mutual affection, love." Now, you may have missed it, and in the English text, it's very easy to miss. He just reconciled the Billy Graham group and the Blue Like Jazz group like that. And the first century reader would have caught it, would have almost double-ticked. And we can start out by just looking at how this is considered an ethical list, okay, in for first century literature. But what we have to look at is how he starts it and how he ends it, because this is key. Let's look at the first thing to notice here is he starts out with faith. He says, "For this very reason, make every effort by your faith." So faith is kind of like the foundation of it. It's the first thing that appears in this list. Your translation may say, add to your faith. The idea is faith is at the foundation. And it works all the way up. The end of the list is love. Now, remember I told you the Greek reading this whole thing? This would have blown them away because they saw ethical lists all the time. But the thing is that the word, the virtue you start with is critical. It's the foundation. It's what you believe is the start of it all. And the word you end with is the culmination. It's where it's all going. So the Greek would see that structure and expect to see the word knowledge here or here. It's not there. In the Christian version of this, faith, love. And if you look at other Christian lists, when Christians do it, they follow this pattern all the time. You can see Paul do this. I mean, you can see a different Christian literature. They take these lists, they believe faith is a foundation, and it's all leading to love. Makes sense, though, if you take a step back. If we're entering this relationship with Jesus because we're drawn to the purity, we want to be like him, and we have this promise that we will share in the divine nature, yeah, you really can be like him. What is the thing that defines who he is? Love. Specifically, loving other people. Should it surprise us that this whole thing, where it all leads, is loving other people? Shouldn't, really. Now, some of us, who kind of like to always find a way to squeeze knowledge in there, a little bit disappointed it's not the foundation or the culmination. But that's okay. We'll get over it. But this is how the structure is. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how he actually starts this passage, because it's very parallel. It says, "For this very reason, make every effort by your faith, you know, to produce virtue." Here's the problem. Because this thing was so steeped in Greek philosophy, and it's so hard to translate, if you read whatever version you have, I guarantee you it's going to look different than what's up here. In the effort to try to make it readable in English, you have to kind of jump a little bit away from the meaning of the text. What I tried to do in this list is be more true to the text, which is why it seems so awkward and weird, all right? But the idea is that the image that's conjured up by the words here goes back to another first century practice where you have these big plays and dramatic Greek plays that would happen. And you'd have these very wealthy sort of benefactors that would sponsor the play. And they would be competing to sponsor. They want to be the one that has all the money to throw this lavish production, to fund the costumes and the everything. And people would fight and bid to be the one that got to do that. It's sort of a place of honor and prestige. But it took an enormous amount of work and an enormous amount of resources. That's the image that Peter is using here for how we move from these one virtue to the other. Is start out with your faith, this thing that got you jumping into this relationship in the first place. And use that with all that you have. Make every effort to move it to virtue. Now, let's continue this through the section for a little bit and see where this goes. Virtue, it's hard for us to translate a little bit. Because this is one of those words that only shows up kind of here. But in a Greek would read this almost as moral energy. Talk about an abstract concept. But use that faith to produce almost a moral energy. And look where it goes. And then use that moral energy to acquire knowledge. This is the knowledge that we normally think of. It's a different word than what was in the previous few verses. This is where knowledge actually fits into the equation. That desire to, you know, that virtuous life should lead you to knowledge. And where does the knowledge lead you to? Self-control. As we learn about who God is, as we learn about our faith, that's the stuff that we draw upon all that to move toward the self-control lifestyle. To know when to just hold back, to bite our tongue, to resist the urge. That's the critical piece where knowledge comes in. Now, again, as Billy Graham, he's reaching to people who've made that, they have that faith jump there. Their moral energy is there. It's just a matter of bringing in the knowledge at a crusade. But you can see where this can get us in a mess if they don't have that faith as the foundation. But here's the other problem. For those folks that are reacting against it, they can have a bridge out. If you take knowledge completely out of this equation, if you say, you know what, it doesn't matter to learn all this information. You don't want to learn doctrine. You don't need to develop a better understanding of the Bible. It's very hard to go from faith to love. You got a bridge out. It breaks. But it's important to see where knowledge leads. It leads to self-control. It's not just acquiring knowledge for knowledge's sake. It's acquiring knowledge so we can live better. Let's move on to the next section. By self-control, steadfastness. By steadfastness, godliness. By godliness, mutual affection. By mutual affection, love. So it's self-control, the ability to hold back, leads to endurance. Yeah, I can weather a pretty hard storm if I've developed self-control in my life. And if I can weather a pretty hard storm, that can lead me to godliness. And those are the ingredients that are required for mutual affection. And by this is unfortunately translated brotherly love. It's basically love between other Christians. But our culture has a hard time, you know, fully grasping that. This is loving other Christians in the church. Yes, it takes endurance. It takes self-control. It takes a bit of knowledge to love other Christians in the church. But that's what actually helps us get to the final part of this, which is love, which is loving non-Christians, loving people outside the church. And now the cycle is complete. We really are like Jesus. This is where it all has to lead. So this actually, as I've kind of worked through this, this just impersonally, it almost was freeing for me. Because we tend to, in my bias, is to have a very, like I said, knowledge approach to my faith. It goes like, if you run into somebody who believes differently than you, and you're of this mindset, what's your natural inclination? Straighten them out. You believe wrong. If we clear up what you believe, then you can have faith. That's my bias. Worked great when we had a different culture. Doesn't work so well right now. We can get into theological arguments before we actually can see someone come into faith. We can get an idea, we can get a false understanding that the more you know about God, the more spiritual you are. And are shocked when somebody has a very different lifestyle than their spiritual knowledge. We can get pretty hung up there. We can complicate it. But to know that, you know what it all boils down to is we just need to put every effort of our spiritual walk to loving other people. Is that it? It's simple. It's very liberating and refreshing. For those of you that have kind of a different default bias, the challenge there is to say, you know, your default is to probably say, isn't Christianity about loving other people? Isn't it already about a relationship? Where's the newsflash there? What I want to just challenge you is to remember, don't neglect the knowledge. Don't neglect learning more about God, because that will enable you to love people more. It's a critical component. If you leave that out, you've got a bridge out kind of thing. I want to share just a couple stories of just how we could live just slightly differently. These are people that I know. First one, I know a family. They actually walk around with a stack of $10 bills in their wallet. They always have a stack of $10 bills. Now, obviously, that alone gives you a little bit of a neon light. Well, they probably have a few more resources than most people. They're just walking around with stacks of $10 bills. They use it to tip fast food workers. As they, you know, you go to McDonald's, yeah, burger, fries, oh, thanks, you know, and they understand out of just love for this person, you're not just a cog in a machine. You're not responsible for, in 15 seconds, getting the fries out and doing this. I'm not just going to blow right past you, hey, thanks, hand them a 10. It's a different mentality. Whenever I share here at Capital, I always have my little focus groups. I will talk through my message with all my non-Christian friends. And they have different, it's funny, I've got, you know, secular Jew, Hindu, bunch of agnostics, LDS, you know, other Christians. I mean, I've got, you know, but I try to really get the agnostics to kind of weigh in a little bit. It's an odd group. Many of them practice or follow Lent. I don't get that. It's a weird group. So if I ever come out really strange, you know that I just have been talking to strange people. But I said, what if a Christian lived that way with this agnostic group? I said, what if a Christian, like their whole focus of where they were going was loving other people. That was like the focus of it, you know, and using that kind of these kind of stories. And he said, oh, that would, no. And I said, why? He said, well, number one, that would totally screw up my whole understanding of what a Christian is. Why? It's way too Christian. That one took me a little while to digest. But seriously, if love is the culmination, that, I mean, that's where this is all going. Another story, which is really remarkable. A friend of mine who isn't in the place to carry around $10 bills lives in a more modest part of the Salt Lake area. It's at a grocery store. And he sees that the woman in front of him is paying with food stamps. And so if you're familiar with the food stamp program, you can buy certain groceries with food stamps and other items you have to pay separately. So you have to ring up two transactions. So she's handling the food stamp transaction, some milk and meat and things, and is just sharing just she needed more milk, needed more meat, but that's all her food stamps would cover for her family. And so she had some additional groceries left over. And she gave the food stamps for transaction one. Transaction two, the extra groceries came out to about $20. She opens her purse and has $3. And just crashes right there, right in the grocery line. Completely breaks down crying. That was it. That was the last straw. She thought she had 20. She had 3. And that was it. And my friend is just watching her just completely melt down. And she's just, I mean, it's like she's trying to feed her family. And she thought she had more. And so my friend just jumped in and said, hey, hold on. I'll cover this $20. And tell you what I want you to do is go back and get all the food stamp items. Just go and double up on that, and I'll cover those too. I'll just sit here and wait for you. And the woman gets composure, goes back, gets more meat, more milk, and such, you know. When it's all said and done, you know, you think, well, that blank check cost him $32. I don't want to, you know, it's not an insignificant amount of money. But it is amazing to realize that $32 is the difference between somebody completely breaking down in a grocery line. And $32 was the amount of help it took to help this woman, you know. And it just seemed like a natural thing. And it'd be cool if that was the end of the story. But it isn't. A couple days later, friend gets out to his car, sees a little note with a Chili's gift card there for $20. Picks it up, and it says, hey, I saw what you did for that woman at the grocery store. That was really cool. Enjoy yourself. And what it turns out is he was at a neighborhood grocery store. A neighbor was there. He didn't see them, but the neighbor was watching to see how this guy handles that situation because the woman made such a scene in that grocery line. And the fact that he stepped right up, helped her out, brought the whole thing through, really stirred up that other person. And so they went out and wanted to bless him. This is sort of the model that we have here. These are just simple, relatively simple examples. In conclusion, what I'd like you to just think is, where has this path taken us? We realize we have a blind spot here. We each have a blind spot. For some of us, we can get so caught up in learning about God that we can forget that where it all leads is loving other people. And that it really is based out of a relationship with who Jesus is. Wanting to be like him and to know more and know more and to know him more. And to get closer and closer to him and have that change us to love the very thing that he loves so much. For others, the challenge is don't neglect learning more about God so that you can love more. Don't have a bridge out in your own spiritual journey. It'd be so cool if we could just focus on this and have this neat balance between loving others and trying to learn more about God. I invite all of you to stand. Lord, help us. Help us, God, to realize why it is we're here. Help us all to love the very people that you love so much. The people we can sometimes even cast aside, but are so very important to you. Help us also to learn more about who you are so that we can love them more. Lead us down this journey. In Jesus' name, amen.